Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like now to welcome Bart Trescott. He is Professor Emeritus from Southern Illinois University, and he will be in Santa Fe for the Spotlight on China events starting Tuesday, the 2nd of June, sponsored by the Santa Fe Council on International Relations. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So, you point out in one of your papers that in 1902, an English economist predicted that China would eventually turn the tables on Western industrial nations, and by adopting their capital and by substituting their own, they might flood their markets with cheaper manufacturers, and refusing imports in exchange might take payment in liens upon their capital, thus reversing the earlier process of investment. Basically, this guy predicted the situation that China is now in relation with America and other Western nations.
Yeah, I came across this quote just about 2 years ago, and I was absolutely floored by it. And so I asked myself, how did he know this? He'd never been to China, for one thing, but of course the English were very involved with China trade. And the most plausible thing I can think of is that he had some considerable intuition about Chinese entrepreneurship and about the well-known quality of many traditional Chinese products like porcelains and fabrics.
What is the status of China's much-touted economic boom right now at this moment?
Okay. China has taken a considerable hit from the world slump because, of course, they have a huge export sector, and as the Western countries went into decline, the same was true in China. But also their domestic manufacturers felt a pinch from the world credit markets as well. And interestingly enough, China and the United States are the two countries that have adopted really massive fiscal stimulus packages. And as a proportion of gross domestic product, China's is even bigger than ours. And the evidence is that the Chinese economy is stabilizing, and that benefits the United States because China buys stuff from us. And if their economy moves ahead, they'll buy more stuff from us.
What is the nature of their stimulus compared to ours?
It's fiscal, that is, it involves increases in government spending. And a big part of the focus of their stimulus is on facilitating consumption by low-income people in the rural sectors. So what they're doing is subsidizing all kinds of particularly durable goods that rural households might buy. And China's had a problem in recent years in that the rural sectors have not benefited as much from the economic boom as have the urban sectors. So this is an effort to deal with that.
So what does that actually translate into? Things like refrigerators
or
what?
Yeah, exactly. Household appliances are a big part of it.
I think one of the great tragedies of inequality, whether it be in a nation or in the whole world, is that people in rich nations have way too much stuff, and people in poor nations have way too little, or poor sectors within that nation. Is there actually a kind of impetus toward something like equality?
No, I think inequality in China proportionately has probably increased. But what has happened is that the general level of poverty in China has decreased by a marked degree. While waiting for your call, I was reading an article in the London Economist from last December, and they have a chart in here that shows World Bank estimates of poverty in China since the 1970s, and the World Bank estimate of Chinese poverty in the rural sector was about 60% around 1980, and it is less than 10% now. So I think that's the kind of result that we need to pay attention to, because the economic boom in China has really benefited a lot of people. But, of course, some people have just made fantastic benefits from it. I mean, there are lots of Chinese people now who are living better than you and me.
Well, that's a question that I wanted to ask you, is how, I mean, you know, the eternal question for every country ultimately boils down to distribution of wealth. Are there mechanisms for seeing to it that poorer people do benefit? I mean, before the stimulus package.
The answer is yes. I think I sent you one of my presentations called Humanizing China's Economy.
Right.
And what that describes is the fact that the government has outlined a pretty extensive program of welfare state stuff, medical insurance, for example. And what's difficult to judge is how far this has gone. And at the time I did that presentation, which was 2 years ago, the process had not gone very far, and I think I have not seen much evidence that it has made major headway since then. So my take is that the government is aware of the problem. They're making the right kind of noises, but sometimes that they settle for noises, and the payoff, it may take something like the stimulus package to boost us along a little harder.
It does speak to a kind of silver lining of economic bust cycles.
Yeah, I think that's very true. Just as in this country, people think that a benefit of the slump will be that we'll get a reform of health insurance. I have my fingers crossed about that.
Right.
But there's a parallel there. I mean, China is trying to advance on that same front that we are. The Chinese health system has had far more serious problems than we've had because they went to the extreme of user charges for every kind of medical goods and services, and the results have been real serious deprivation of medical access by a lot of the population.
What type of social safety net do they have?
They have, theoretically, unemployment insurance, but you have to remember that a very high percentage of the population live in the rural areas, at least 50%, so they're not covered by unemployment insurance. And there have been a lot of stories in the last couple months about Chinese workers losing their jobs, especially people who have been employed overseas, and people in South China who work in the export sectors. And many of these people have returned home to their rural households. And in a sense, this is a social safety net that is a very long standing. China has a policy, which I've strongly disapproved of not permitting the rural residents to sell their land. Theoretically, each farm family has the right to use a tract of land. They can rent it out to somebody else, but they can't sell it. And the problem with this is that it blocks you from having mortgage credit because you can't offer the farm as collateral. And it also blocks people from selling out and having a grub stake, which they could use to set themselves up in the cities. But the Chinese government doesn't want to let loose of this policy for exactly the reason we're seeing now, and that is that having this household there gives a lot of workers the opportunity to return back to their traditional home when they lose their job in the city. So there are a huge number of Chinese families where one or more of the family members has a job in the city, and maybe they get home twice a year. They send money back home, and that helps to support the families that are otherwise not doing very well. That's a very primitive kind of social safety net.
Right. China, as you write, has a high savings rate, which certainly is a contrast, I think, to us. Does that mean that people have enough disposable income to actually save money?
Yes. A lot of them do, and a lot of them save money even out of incomes that we would regard as being very, very meager. Now, the reasons for their saving, again, are partly related to the lack of a social safety net, because people feel that they're going to have to save money to be prepared for their old age, that the old age pension system still is not very extensive nor very lucrative, and they need to accumulate money for medical expenses. They need to accumulate money for their children's education because the educational system has gone very heavily into user charges, just as the health system has. So the high saving rate is not necessarily just a mark of superior virtue by the Chinese, but it has been a significant force helping their economic growth.
Let's talk for a moment about trade. Generally, countries favor free trade when it benefits them, and they favor tariffs and protectionist policies when that's to their economic advantage. Talk about the politics of free trade and protectionism in the last decade, and, you know, going back to the end of the 20th century vis-a-vis China, the U.S., and Europe.
Well, I wouldn't accept your characterization. I think within every country there is a free trade lobby and there is a protectionist lobby, and it depends on precisely which industries and which categories of workers benefit or are damaged by freer trade. In the United States, our farm sector has traditionally been a supporter of free trade because we're a big exporter of farm stuff, and we also export a lot of vehicles, a lot of heavy machinery, and of course entertainment goods and services of all kinds, software, things like that. But many of our traditional manufactured products, like textiles and clothing and even raw materials such as steel, they have been pressed pretty hard by competition from China. China was not really a big factor in American trade until the last 20 or 25 years. One of the things the communists did was essentially shut down real foreign trade by China. The Marxists didn't regard trade as a productive activity. They were materialists. They favored production of things. So they neglected transport and services and stuff like that. But obviously, as everyone knows, over the past 25 years, China has come roaring into the world economy as a major exporter. And again, this article I've just been reviewing in the London Economist is talking about the trade policies. And I've also been reading material about China's exchange rate. And the general consensus view there is that China's exchange rate, the value of the renminbi, is about 25% higher than it ought to be if the goal were to have equilibrium in international trade between China and the rest of the world. The exchange rate is not the dominant factor in this trade imbalance, and the fact that China's trade with the U.S. is unbalanced in one direction is somewhat compensated by the fact that China has an import surplus with a lot of its raw material suppliers, and the fact that the U.S. has an export surplus with a lot of countries other than China. But a big factor in the trade imbalance between the U.S. and China is the difference in the saving rate. If you go through the workings of traditional macroeconomic theory, you'll find that a country's domestic saving rate correlates pretty well with its international trade balance. And the U.S. having such a low saving rate over the past 20 years is a big factor getting us into the financial mess we're currently in. And it's also a big factor in the fact that we imported so much stuff from China. So I'm delighted that the U.S. saving rate is going back up. Of course, it makes it harder to recover from this current recession. but it's going to make our economy much healthier if we can stick with it.
That's a very interesting interaction of things. I mean, one thinks of saving as such a personal decision, and you don't, when you decide to save money, you don't think of it in terms of international trade balance.
Right.
You were speaking before about the Chinese entrepreneurial spirit. What is the state of entrepreneurship in China now? Is there a lot of small business entrepreneurship, or is it more large companies selling just countless masses of shoes and things like that? What's going on?
Everything. They have entrepreneurship from top to bottom, and it permeates the political system as well as the business system. And we're very much aware, because of our personal connection, with entrepreneurs who are in high-tech stuff. One of our good friends is a Chinese entrepreneur who is developing a software company that caters primarily to law enforcement. And the Chinese are big on computers. They have more internet users than we do. They are really pushing hard to develop high-end kinds of computer-oriented goods and services. But they are also very good entrepreneurs about very basic stuff. But one of the problems with China's economy is that it is not a high-consumption economy. The share of consumer spending in China's GDP is only about 40%, and in this country it's closer to 65 or 70%. So many economists claim that China's economy is very unbalanced, in that there is way too much of their total output going into extremely capital-intensive manufacturing, which does not create a huge amount of jobs and correspondingly does not create huge wage income or provide a basis for a mass consumption society. So the stimulus stuff that I spoke of earlier is a little bit of a remedy to that.
It's interesting because when you look at the United States and some of the problems we have, a lot of people point to consumerism because of not only the kind of spiritual wasteland created by an overly consumerist society, but also because of the vast amounts of pollution caused by that waste. When, you know, you talk about remedies to a country that has a lack of consumerism, do you also keep in mind those potential problems that are being created by trying to stimulate consumerism?
I think the Chinese government's very much aware of this conflict. China has monumental problems with pollution and environmental damage. And, of course, the communist regimes all over the world were among the most notorious for neglecting the environment. And the Olympics, of course, publicized the efforts that Beijing was making to hold down the level of pollution. I think they're trying to hang on to that orientation, but they are still, they much exceed the United States in terms of the degree of pollution. And the problem, very simply, is that when you're a low-income country, raising people's incomes comes first, raising their consumption comes next, and protecting the environment comes way down at the bottom of the list of priorities. But they are environmentally aware. Chinese government is good about talking the talk, and they don't always walk the walk, but they're talking the talk about environmental improvement.
Chinese products have a reputation for being cheap, but also of low quality. I was just reading the internet this morning because I was looking for a particular household thing, and on one of those chat boards, they said, whatever you do, don't buy the Chinese version of this product. It's terrible. To what extent is that really true, and to what extent are those things changing?
Well, we lived in China for more than 2 years and just loved to go shopping there. And I would often come across stuff that I thought was exceptional in terms of quality and value. Now, we were looking for special items. But I think their products run the gamut from high quality to the low, and they have not had the same systematic shakeouts and brand development. Branding is one of the ways that a highly developed country raises the level of quality. A brand gets a reputation for high quality, and then people gravitate to it. China has companies like that. They have a multinational company named Hi-R, which sells a lot of stuff in the United States. They make air conditioning equipment. They make TV sets, things like that. You often see in Walmart, places like that. So they're an example of brand development that is working in this direction of quality upgrade.
In one of your articles, you compare China and Japan and Japan's miraculous economic growth and then the problems that they experienced in the 1990s and their comeback from them. How would you compare them to China? They seem like very different countries in terms of their level of development.
Well, what I was trying to get at was the general sense that Japan has stagnated because it's become so bureaucratic. I think since I wrote that, I have not seen much evidence that this is the problem in China, although some of the recent stuff that I've been reading argues that China is moving in the wrong direction in that regard, that they are moved away from state enterprises. I'm quoting, non-state-owned enterprises are now producing two-thirds of China's manufacturing output, but state-owned enterprises dominate key sectors such as banking, telecoms, energy, and the media. Between 2001 and 2006, the number of state-owned enterprises fell from 370,000 to 120,000, but this still left assets worth $1.3 trillion in state control. But the story goes on to say that the Chinese have quit trying to scale back the state-owned enterprises, and they are essentially beefing them up now.
What kind of state-owned enterprises are you talking about?
Well, go back to this one part of the quote. State-owned enterprises dominate key sectors such as banking, telecoms, energy, and the media. I'm very much aware of the banking part because I pretend to be a monetary economist, and because my wife and I, every time we go to China, we try to test out the banking system to see how well they're doing consumer services, and they've been very, very slow to modernize. We were there in 2004, for instance. We had a significant amount of American currency that was given us as expense reimbursement. I wanted to get a cashier's check so it would be safer to carry it back home, and we couldn't find a bank that would sell us a cashier's check in dollars for actual dollar currency that we had in hand. Well, that's primitive.
We're talking to Professor Bart Trescott. When we think about China being a communist government, what does that mean at this point? What is communist about it? Yeah, there are some state-owned enterprises. What else? I mean, is it a philosophical or economic reality at this point?
Well, I think the key word is probably political power, that the communists seized power in China by force. They've never been willing to go to the electorate and have a genuine free election. And so the content of what the communist government does changes from year to year depending on what they need to keep themselves in power. And they know very well that they have to pay attention to public opinion, and they know very well that public opinion wants economic improvement and perhaps a certain amount of nationalistic bluster over Taiwan, for example, or over the Olympics and things like that. But if I were to pinpoint one element of continuity with real communism, it would be a strain of intellectual dishonesty. I mean, communist doctrine is based on force and fraud, and the present-day regime maintains a lot of the fraud with regard to Chinese history. They still use the term liberation to describe the communist seizure of power in 1949, even though it created a very oppressive and mass-murdering dictatorship. That's not my idea of liberation. China experienced real liberation in 1976 when Mao Zedong died, and the whole character of the government just changed dramatically after that time. But as far as recognizably communist enterprises, I would say that this maintenance of the state-owned enterprises in the key sectors is a traditional Leninist, Stalinist, Maoist approach to both political and economic power, that the government hangs on to these because they are both politically and economically powerful.
Is there enough political freedom at this point, freedom of speech, to even get a handle on how the masses of people or various groups of people within China feel about the political system?
I would say there is a remarkable degree to which individuals in China are free to speak their mind as long as they don't try to put their ideas into action by organizing political parties or mass demonstrations or things like that. I don't get the sense that our Chinese connections are remotely reticent. They never have been. We've been going to China off and on since 1983, and I never really had the sense that we were particularly constrained about what we could say or what other people would say to us. But the official press and the media are under a considerable amount of state control, and there's always the element of risk. I've done a lot of research into Chinese intellectual history, and a lot of that stuff, as far as the 20th century goes, is still pretty sensitive. And every once in a while you read about some researcher who gets in real trouble because of what the government calls revealing state secrets. I have no doubt that some of the material I've dug up would be considered state secrets. So there's always that threat that they, because they don't have due process, and they people are arrested for trumped-up charges and they are held without real right to counsel or anything of that sort. But compared to the way China was in the past, it is vastly less oppressive. It never has been oppressive in the times that we've been there. The Chinese people have a remarkable degree of personal freedom, and I think they're aware of it, and they're aware how much better off they were than 25 or more years ago.
And then there's some very strange pockets that contradict that. For example, I had on the air not too long ago a woman whose husband had been killed by the Chinese government for being a vociferous practitioner of Falun Gong, which is essentially a kind of, as I understand it, like Tai Chi or yoga or something.
That's
like
right.
That.
That's right, yeah. The persecution of the Falun Gong has been a real black mark on the Chinese, and I have not the slightest doubt that displays all the bad things that used to go on routinely under Mao Zedong, where you target a group of people, in this case nonviolent, non-political people, and you just try to exterminate them. I mean, I'm sure that quite a few of them have been killed. But the government just had the sense that this was a real threat to their political stability. But on the other hand, my wife and I are substantially devoted to our Christian faith, and we are very much aware of how rapidly Christian worship has spread in China. Some people claim there may be as many as 100 million Christian devotees in China, and a lot of that worship is outside of the state-controlled sector, but it is spreading, and it shows up. One way it showed up was in the non-governmental response that the Chinese people made to this earthquake within the last year out in Sichuan province. And I think the Christian communities in China were a big part of the explanation of how that happened.
Professor Truscott, what do you think that our two countries, the United States and China, have to learn from each other?
Well, I think the Chinese need to learn a lot more about the meaning of freedom and the meaning of democracy and the fact that these are potentially functional arrangements. What Americans have to learn from China is that this is a civilization that has been in existence for many, many, many centuries. And what has constantly impressed me is the depth and breadth of all types of culture in China: literature, art, music, dance, drama, philosophy. The Chinese are a great nation of readers. They read voraciously, far more than Americans do. And literacy in China has tremendous cachet. A Chinese cultured individual is a person who is skilled at calligraphy, the artistic forms of handwriting. And I think Americans who deal with China are in danger of not being able to appreciate the breadth and really incredible value that is involved in all these dimensions of Chinese art, philosophy, intellectual endeavor, and so on. The one downside of Chinese culture is that their intellectual life has a substantial involvement with rote learning, and I think it has to do with the language, because the traditional language in China is not an alphabetical language. Every individual Chinese ideograph has to be memorized, and it's unique pronunciation. And so Chinese kids grow up with a lot more rote learning, I think, than American kids do. So we see it in our graduate students that as long as Chinese students come here, they eat up all the mathematical stuff because they know how to do that. But as soon as you say, okay, choose a topic of your own choice for research, they are totally stumped. The idea of having a creative and imaginative approach to research is something that's very hard for them to do.
We're talking to Professor Bart Truscott. The last thing I wanted to ask you was, what does it mean for the relation between our two countries that we essentially owe China so very much money?
Well, I think that's simply one dimension of the fact that we have a huge range of mutual interests. I mean, the Chinese obviously have an interest in getting paid, and they don't want to do anything that will damage the solvency of those huge amounts of U.S. government securities that they're holding. But I think our mutual interests extend into the fact that we trade abundantly with each other, and each side benefits by being able to import the goods that the other one produces. And China is still in the position of needing to import huge amounts of capital and entrepreneurship and technological knowledge. Of course, the overseas Chinese are a huge source of this kind of benefit. You can't talk about China's economic improvement in the past 25 years without recognizing that the overseas Chinese have been an enormous contribution to that. But we're also at a point where non-Chinese business firms and individuals are moving to China. I certainly recommend to college-age people that they learn Chinese language. There are just so many opportunities to live and work and enjoy. I mean, China is a wonderful place to live. in many respects, and you can plug in yourself to all the extraordinary richness of Chinese culture and Chinese history and Chinese tradition.
Did you learn Chinese?
Well, my wife can speak more of it than I can. My Chinese language is still very limited. I probably have maybe 200 or 300 words that I can deal with in common speech. So I can rattle off a whole list of foods, for example.
Right.
Because then I can order, if I go to a restaurant and I ask if they have chiazza, I can tell them that I need kuaizha, which means chopsticks, and things like that. So food language comes very quickly. And we can talk to the taxi drivers and ask them how much the taxi fare is going to be, and we can say taiguela, which means it's too much, we won't pay it. Things like that are very useful. But my wife has taken the Chinese language course here a couple of times, and she is quite comfortable having conversations with, she loves to talk to Chinese kids and to some of the older Chinese people that come here to our university because they're helping their kids who are students. And the older people don't have English, and often they're very lonesome. And they're always delighted to find somebody like my wife who can have a conversation with them.
Bart Trescott is Professor Emeritus from Southern Illinois University, and he will be in Santa Fe for the Spotlight on China events starting on Tuesday, June 2nd. Sponsored by the Santa Fe Council on International Relations. You can find out more by going to sfcir.com or calling 505-982-4931. Professor Trescott, thanks so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity.
We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to introduce Jennifer Hoffman. She is Deputy Cabinet Secretary at the New Mexico Tourism Department. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much for having me.
So the Tourism Department, first of all, what does the Tourism Department do? Basically advertise New Mexico so that people elsewhere will come here?
Yeah, the Tourism Department has, its main objective is to bring tourism to New Mexico, which is over $5.5 billion direct spending impact on the state every year. So second to oil and gas, we're a really important and big industry here in the state. And our goal is to reach out to visitors from all over the world and tell them about the treasures that we have here and hope that they'll come and visit us.
I would think that for Santa Fe, it's kind of a no-brainer. Getting them to go to the border of Mexico or the western? I mean, how do you get them to go other places besides here?
Santa Fe is a given. It's our most popular destination and sort of that well-trodden trail between Albuquerque and Taos, including Santa Fe, is a really popular place for a lot of people. But the kind of traveler that we're seeing travel trends change, and people want a more experiential, hands-on, authentic experience, and they're willing to go out into rural areas to get that. For example, recently I went to Puyehue Cliffs grand opening up at Santa Clara Pueblo. Since the Cerro Grande fire 9 years ago, it's been closed. And that's off the beaten path, but it's worth getting to. And so those are the kind of things we like to tell travelers, potential travelers, about here in the state.
So, I mean, it is sort of funny in my mind when you think about people want an authentic experience, so the New Mexico Tourism Department is going to basically package authentic experiences for them.
Yeah, I mean, we're not packaging it for them. Actually, an emphasis that I'm trying to make right now in the ecotourism, this new initiative for ecotourism in New Mexico is actually the first of its kind, really, in the country. There are other states that do things like ecotourism, geotourism, and that type of travel. It's a big name, and it covers a lot of things. So what we're trying to do is basically take the existing reasons why people visit the land of enchantment already, which is scenic beauty and cultural heritage. And you take those two things and repackage them and rebrand them as ecotourism.
So what is ecotourism?
Well, ecotourism is a nature-based form of responsible travel that benefits local communities. So it is a more rural initiative than, say, just bringing people to Canyon Road to see art galleries.
Right.
While that's also hugely important and knowing Santa Fe as the second biggest art market in the country to New York City, you know, that's a great reason to visit the state. But with ecotourism, we're looking to bring a certain type of traveler that stays longer, spends more money, and is interested in giving back to the communities that they visit. For example, I just recently visited with Barbara Gonzalez, Maria Martinez's great-granddaughter. Maria Martinez from Santa Clara, or San Ildefonso, excuse me.
The great potter.
Famous for the black-on-black pottery, right. And so visiting with Barbara in her studio, which is open to the public, you know, and meeting the artist who creates some of this world-renowned pottery is exactly the kind of experience that an eco-tourist wants to have.
So that's not exactly eco per se. I mean, that's like a cultural experience. But if they're, you know, throwing bottled water bottles around and things like that, they're creating just as much pollution as they were on any other kind of tourism.
And I think that's a great example of how when you use something as big as the word eco, you automatically want to talk about recycling bottles, and you want to talk about water catchment systems, and all of that can definitely be a part of this initiative. In fact, what we're trying to do is the ecotourism initiative for the tourism department is one of the few, if not the only, new program that received funding from this year's legislature. And we want to take that money and contract with a destination management group that is certified as an ecotourism management group, and they will come and they may be a New Mexico company. We're in the process of creating our request for proposal.
Okay.
And then this group will be selected, and they'll come and administer this program. So they'll go throughout the state, take inventory, find where the most feasible locations are. And then part of that also will be putting in a series of eco lodges, so almost like a domestic safari, semi-permanent, permanent tented camps that will be sort of the anchor destinations throughout the state where you're going out and you're having an experience in the wilderness. And I like using domestic safari because people sort of understand that they equate it with Africa, where ecotourism has been happening for decades. And, they can understand, you know, people spend lots of money to go and stay in places like that, have outdoor adventures, view wildlife, go hunting. All those things constitute as ecotourism. And different businesses, tour operators, fly fishing guides, hotels, spas can get certified or become part of the ecotourism program for the state through this new program that we're building. So it includes, you know, the kind of places that are going to use solar energy and water catchment systems.
Composting toilets.
Yeah, exactly. Or El Monte Sagrado in Taos has an extensive water catchment and water reuse system. So there's so much equity that already exists in the state. It's just that going out and finding it, certifying it, and then becoming a clearinghouse of information for people who are interested in this type of travel. It's the fastest growing segment in the travel industry today.
One does think of ecotourism basically mostly to other countries,
right?
Third world countries.
Right. I think New Mexico is,
we're kind of a third world country.
We're so different, and that's what makes us unique, and the fact that we have these huge wide open spaces with an accessible Pueblo, Apache, and Navajo cultures to visit, it sets us apart from the rest of the country. We've always said that, the tourism department anyway. But when you're sort of creating new opportunities, for example, on Pueblo land, if that's something that we can do, build one of these eco camps, have a native guide take you to visit Puyehue Cliffs and talk about their ancestors there. That's, having that kind of experience is totally different, and it would be the first kind of thing of its kind in the entire country. So I think New Mexico has a huge opportunity to stake its claim as the ecotourism destination in the country.
So what is your relationship with the various public land agency? I would think you would be using public lands a lot for this.
Well, one of the really great things about this project is it requires a cross agency and private-public cross-collaboration. And without that community effort, it can't really be successful. So it's not just coming from tourism. This is also something we're doing with the Department of Cultural Affairs, with Game and Fish, with the State Land Office, with State Parks, and with the Pueblos. And so it's just a matter of educating them about what the initiative is and sort of getting some strength and some energy behind it.
How does it link with things like habitat preservation and other conservation efforts?
Well, I think, you've heard newer terms like agritourism or culinary tourism or voluntourism. And voluntourism, you can imagine doing something like maybe restoring silvery minnow habitat or going to visit wolf habitat and those sort of things. So definitely like planting trees, river restoration, I see those things as a crucial element of this project.
So you could work with Wild Earth Guardians or people who are doing that anyway.
Exactly. Eradicating, you know, salt cedar and replanting native plants and essentially, too, I think one of the things that could be really, really important to this is that it is creating a fund where, you know, part of your travel expenses are going into a fund that helps sustain this type of program. So you know when you travel here that you're giving back to the communities in a monetary way. And there are studies that show travelers are willing to pay almost 50% more for their travel expenses if they know there's a green element or an element that gives back to the community by paying that.
Very interesting. I would imagine once this gets underway, it could serve as an example to other states.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's about, you know, we often are afraid of change and we don't want to lose a certain kind of lifestyle here in New Mexico that we appreciate as locals and what drew us here. A ranching lifestyle, working cattle ranches, you know, that's sort of it's a very Western concept. It's a very Western way of life and Native American culture and those sort of things. You have to preserve them, not just promote them. So you want to do both, and I think this is a way in which you can do both. And this is really rooted in a sense of place. How does a landscape affect the way you think and the books that you read and the art that you create and the way you talk? And I think when people travel now, we see these trends in the industry. When they travel, they want to learn those types of things. They want to go and say, I met the artist who made this pot at Indian Market, or, you know, those kinds of experience, they're already here. That richness is already here in New Mexico. We just need to further capitalize on it.
Here we are on the radio talking about it. Would you like to make a call out to people in the public or businesses or other people to get in touch with you? What kind of support are you looking for?
Well, like I said, we're in the process of going out to bid to find that contractor. But I've been continually in the process since joining the department last summer of taking inventory of the things that already exist that can constitute as ecotourism in the state. So,
what are some of those?
Well, any kind of, you know, say a fly fishing guide who gives back to the local hatchery, or a pottery artist who's willing to do hands-on pottery classes for tourists. You know, outdoor adventure tour operators that do llama trekking or river rafting. So anything, you know, that has to do with outdoor adventure and cultural heritage together. But that doesn't exclude, of course, spas, hotels, and other tourism partners who happen to do things that are either eco-friendly and conscious of the environment or have to do with giving back to the local community. And I'm interested in hearing from anybody who's has a foot in that door already, and they can reach out to me by emailing me. It's jennifer.hoffman, H-O-F-F-M-A-N, at state.nm.us.
Jennifer Hoffman is Deputy Cabinet Secretary at the New Mexico Tourism Department. Thanks so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 505-428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show for free on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and then jazz.